10% chance of rain, a high of 43. Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, cloudy and 36. Right now, wind northeast at 8 is overcast with 50 degrees Kenosha, 49 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Before we get to today's morning show with Dr. Thomas Carr, I want to tell you about the morning shows that are coming up for the remainder of the week. Tomorrow on the morning show, out of the archives, a very fun conversation with Kenosha author Michael Schumacher. This particular conversation, which I believe dates back to 2010, concerns his biography of a fascinating figure, Will Eisner. And then on Wednesday, the 27th, we will be airing a tribute to Norm McPhee. Norm McPhee served for several decades as the managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild. And I have assembled interviews with five different people who worked extensively with Norm McPhee, including George Mangold, Mona Lewis, Michael Klickner, Joe Nissen, and Norm's successor at the Theater Guild, Doug Instanis. We also have some recorded stories from others who recollect the experience of working with Norm McPhee. And so all of that will be airing this Wednesday. And then Thursday and Friday, there will be no morning show broadcasts because of the Thanksgiving holiday. The studios of WGTD will be closed, but you're encouraged to seek out the podcast version of the morning show to continue to hear a different morning show all week long. We'll get to today's morning show in just a moment. Thanks for listening. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's program features yet another visit from Dr. Thomas Carr, who has been a frequent guest to the morning show over the past 20 years, ever since joining the faculty of Carthage College back in 2004. Dr. Carr is Associate Professor of Biology and Director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology. He also serves as Senior Scientific Advisor for the Dinosaur Discovery Museum in Kenosha. You may recall that Dr. Carr was on the program a little earlier this fall to talk about the program's most recent field expedition out west. The occasion for this morning show visit today is the recent national meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, which took place a few weeks ago in the Twin Cities. Dr. Carr attended along with half a dozen students who are part of the paleontology program at Carthage. One of those students, Brett Jackson, is soon to graduate from Carthage with a biology degree. And Brett Jackson earned the opportunity to present a poster program at the meeting, one concerning modern-day crocodiles and their extinct ancestors and the difference in their growth rates. And we'll be hearing more about that a little bit later on, and about sort of the gauntlet that must be traveled for someone to earn such an opportunity. Also with us in the studios for today's morning show, Andrew Gable, a recent Carthage graduate who served for a time as a paid field assistant for the paleontology program before, unfortunately, that funding went away. Andrew Gable continues to very generously donate some of his time, volunteer some of his time for the program. And we're going to be hearing from him on how hard at work he is on some of the fossil remains found out west in the most recent field expedition, and some of the work that he is doing in piecing together in painstaking fashion those fossil fragments. Dr. Carr will be talking about the presentation that he made at this most recent meeting of the Society of Vertebrate and Paleontology. And in his words, his presentation on T-Rex is part of an ongoing tussle, and we'll find out what's behind those intriguing words. The conversation, which we recorded last week, begins with Dr. Carr summarizing some of the challenges that the paleontology program has been facing and what they have managed to accomplish despite those challenges and setbacks.
I'd like to begin with just zooming out a bit to emphasize just how remarkable this fall has been. Back in 2020, our preparator position was killed by the college administration, and I kept that going for 3 years on grants. And as the money ran out, and despite the statements of college and city administration that they would help us seek funding to keep that position going, the preparator actually supports the lab and field, so two-thirds of our program are supported by that one person. Seeing no end in sight, and seeing the end of our grant in sight, Dr. Seitz did leave for a new position in May earlier this year, and sort of that really left the program in a very vulnerable position. I was able to hire Andrew on the remainder of that money, and that ran out in August of 24. And so we are presently completely without the kind of qualified support that we need to conserve and prepare the fossils in our lab at the Dinosaur Discovery Museum. And in spite of all of that, this year we managed to bring a group of, I think, seven undergraduate students to the annual meeting of the SVP, as you mentioned, which was in Minneapolis this year. We had two students present, Brett Jackson, who's here with us in the studio, and also a former student, Joseph Krikora, presented a poster on fishes a couple days before Brett's presentation. And both of those posters, I think, went over really well with the scientific audience in attendance. To have a group of students attend SVP from year to year, I think, really conveys to the paleo community that we're thriving, we're moving forward, despite the adversity that we face.
Tell us more about this event that occurred in the Twin Cities, and that was fairly recent, correct?
Yeah, it was just a couple weeks ago.
Right. So tell us more about what this event is and how often it occurs.
Right. So the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology is the professional society of our science. And each year it hosts an annual meeting in a different city, usually alternates between the United States and another country. And it's a gathering over 4 or 5 days of scientists and students to share the results of their research, whether it's scientific or technical, or touches on, you know, ethics or, you know, legal issues, policy, that sort of thing. So it's a meeting of minds. It's one of the most important networking opportunities for students, seeking to make that next step, such as Andrew and Brett were quite active in seeking out potential graduate programs. So it's the meeting of the year. It's critically important for networking and, you know, communicating research results and setting up people's futures.
So generally speaking, how many people are we talking about? And generally speaking, who gathers at this event? I mean, is it sounds like it is intended for both students and for professionals in the field.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I don't think they said how many people were in attendance. They did say it was one of the highest meetings since COVID. So I don't know. I just ballpark it between maybe 1,200 and 2,000.
Wow.
It's hard to, I wasn't counting.
Yeah.
And they didn't give the count, but it's usually, you know, 1,200, something like that. So it's got to be in the neighborhood somewhere above and beyond that. But yeah, it's attended by scientists, graduate students, undergraduate students, in some cases, representatives from government agencies like Bureau of Land Management or the DOI, Department of the Interior. And also artists. And, you know, there's sort of tables set up for people to sell, like, paleontology-related things. So I have a friend, Meg Kirkpatrick, who makes these great pins, and she had a booth.
Yeah.
There's other sort of larger companies, like Research Casting International, which is a company based in Canada that molds and casts dinosaurs and makes museum mounts, this sort of thing. So it represents a very wide swath of the community. You know, the full spectrum from the science to, you know, gallery and exhibit sorts of things.
Right. So explain to listeners, I mean, I have some sense of this from my own life, but I think a lot of people listening might not really understand what's involved in being invited to present at an event like this. What sort of gauntlet are we talking about? And of course, we'll get to Brett Jackson in just a moment, who successfully traversed that gauntlet. But explain what an honor it is to be asked to represent, to present something, and what is involved in securing that kind of invitation.
Right. So the way the meeting's organized is there's daily sessions of presentations. So these are platform presentations, slideshows that are given that feature a researcher's latest work. These are 15-minute slots. Usually the talks are 12 minutes with a few minutes for questions and answers. And in the afternoons, there is a room set up with posters. You know, it's exactly what it sounds like, you know, with text and pictures of a person's latest research. So it's a place, that's how the results of research are communicated, or research in progress. And the way you land a spot in a meeting like this is to submit an abstract, and that's a paragraph that describes what you've done, what your results are, and that gets reviewed and a decision's made whether or not you're presenting at all, and also whether it's considered for a platform or a poster. And, you know, you submit all this online, and you can pick, you know, if you only want a poster, you can do that. If you prefer a talk, but there's no space for you, you know, you can click, well, you know, I'll take a poster if I can't have a talk, this sort of thing. But there is a vetting process. And I'm very happy to say that in all the years of my students submitting abstracts, we've only had one turned away. And that does not reflect on the merit of the work. At all. It was mostly based on sort of subfossil material, and so we thought, yeah, this is a bit of a roll of the dice, but universally our students have presented at SVP.
Wow. And I guess part of that is you have a good sense that what they have put together is quality work and involves something that will be of interest to others. And I mean, that's part of this process, is understanding what is worthy of these kind of opportunities.
Yeah, there's almost a formula to it. You know, an abstract is sort of a summary of a research paper, so it has to have an introduction, has to have a hypothesis, expected results, methodology results, and conclusions, maybe a bit of discussion. But that basic formula has to be there, along with any results of any quantitative test. And without any of those components, the probability of being accepted drops precipitously.
Right.
So I make sure that my students have every single element accounted for, because I want them there because they need to network for their next step in their professional career.
Right. Well, Brett Jackson was successful in that gauntlet, and so Brett is who we're going to be talking to next. He is about to graduate from Carthage with a biology major, hailing from Emmitsburg, Iowa. So tell us how somebody from little Emmitsburg, Iowa, becomes so interested in paleontology, and is that what drew you to Carthage College?
Sure. Yeah, it is. I think everybody's at least a little interested in dinosaurs at some point in time in their lives. And I've always been interested in sciences. I've been an outdoorsman my entire life. So, you know, mixing science, outdoors, and dinosaurs together, it brought me to paleontology. And Carthage College is one of the best undergraduate paleo programs in the country. So it was a natural choice for me.
And you pursued it because you're just interested in dinosaurs, or did you have more specific thoughts in mind in terms of why you wanted to study it?
I've always been interested in the sciences in general. I love biology in general, but I am more just interested in like natural history and sciences. It goes beyond dinosaurs. I love the study of evolution, and this kind of all brings it together in paleontology.
Right. So tell us about the independent study that you were engaged in with Professor Carr that led to this presentation that you made at the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology this fall.
So it was a class that Dr. Carr hosted. There I was able to work on research as in partnership with Dr. Carr and by myself. We met every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I was able to conduct my research, read literature, and do the analysis while also balancing other classes. So it gave me a time to do my research as well.
Is this a typical sort of timetable or scenario in which this kind of work gets done?
Yeah, we give, so it's a 4-credit experience, and so it's 6 hours a week, and we can divide that into a couple 3-hour chunks or 3 2-hour chunks, depending on our schedules. And Brett's particular focus was growth in living alligators and extinct relatives, which was pretty cool.
Yeah. So tell us more about that, about specifically the question that you were exploring in this work.
Sure. So my work focused on ontogeny, which is the study of growth and development. I chose alligator partially because it is a living animal, so it's easy to study, and it has a quite diverse fossil record for its ancient relatives. There are many ancient alligators out there that's not had a lot of work done on it. They're quite fragmentary, or not a lot of studies have been done, so I thought I should tackle this by comparing modern alligators with their extinct relatives to see if I can see how they grow and change through the fossil record.
Wow. So Dr. Carr, it sounds like that is often an element of this, is that you want somebody probing into something that has not been completely explored already. I mean, where there are questions to be answered or information to be uncovered.
Right. So what we do at Carthage is ontogeny. We do growth, and we study growth to uncover how evolutionary change comes about. And each student works on a different group of animals, because I want them to have their own project that they can call their own, and that they can present that as their own work at these meetings. So I don't stick my name on the students' projects. I'm just a guide. And I walk them through the techniques, through the methods, the software to use. And so there's about a month of pretty intensive training, and then for the rest of that time they're kind of doing analyses and then put an abstract together in time for SVP. So part of the deal is that this happens spring semester of junior year, and then the deadline for submitting abstract to SVP is in, you know, March or April. And so their basic work has to be done by the time that deadline rolls around. And then they can just, you know, present that work the following fall. In the fall, they add to that project and their senior thesis. And so there's no double dipping happening. It's just they're expanding that project by, you know, doing analyses of new and different animals and sort of build out the overall project.
Excellent. So tell us, Brett, in layman's terms, if you would, please, kind of the nature of what you discovered or the kind of things that you ended up presenting. I mean, what did you end up learning about the way the modern alligator grows versus its extinct ancestors?
Yeah. So my focus was more on the fossil specimens. We quite know how modern alligators grow, so it was more of a comparison. However, I did uncover several patterns, shared, you know, ways they grow and change in their lifetime. These ancient alligators are quite similar as we would expect to modern alligator, but they do have some interesting differences. There's some changes that we don't see until later in life in modern alligators, so it was really interesting to see these different patterns emerge in the fossil record.
Could you give one or two specific examples? I mean, and are we talking about like a particular part of the body that we see different sorts of growth patterns? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. So specifically, I'm focusing on different aspects of the bones and how those bones change. One example I could give is a ridge in between the eyes. On the bone, there is a prominent ridge that develops over time. So the hatchlings, the babies, they don't have this. And as they grow and develop, they actually, their bones change. They grow these ridges and rugosities on there.
So your presentation, is it images? Is it mostly text? Is it mostly numbers? I mean, what did this presentation look like and or sound like?
So I organized my poster to be kind of a mix of text and pictures, excuse me. So I have my text describing what I did and my results, as well as several graphs that show the specific changes in image form, as well as some tables that I used that I used in my analysis. So it was kind of 50-50 for images and text.
Right. And of course, a poster presentation means that you're kind of standing there waiting for people to stop and take in what you're doing. Is that how it works logistically?
So I stand next to my poster, and then people who walk around the room hopefully come to my poster and ask me about it, and that gives me a chance to kind of talk one-on-one with people, maybe explain if they have questions.
Right. So tell us a little more about those kind of interactions and how important that was as an experience in and of itself.
Sure. It was a great experience for me personally. I was able to practice talking about my research. It also gave me an opportunity to talk with professionals in the field, potential graduate professors. It gave me an example or a way to interact with the community on another level.
Right. Professor Carr, what's your assessment of how Brett did with this opportunity?
I think Brett and Joe really managed things admirably. They were well-dressed. They showed up on time. And they did engage with the people that stopped by their posters. It was a real pleasure to see. And I would, you know, hang by, you know, for a bit and just to see how things were going. And I was happy to see that Brett and Joe were getting a good amount of attention. Interested attention, you know, people did read, they did, you know, engage with the students, and that's exactly what you know, we want to see. So sure. it was good. I mean, engagement happened, and that's the name of the game at this stage.
Right. So Brett, is this work that you hope you will build upon? I mean, is this just the beginning in terms of you exploring this particular topic, or do you see yourself moving on to other matters?
I definitely see this as a bedrock for my future research. I learned a lot of skills, and it gave me great experience. I do want to expand on this work, so My main focus is to continue working on alligators and crocodiles. Where that brings me, I've yet to decide yet, but it's definitely something I want to expand on in the future.
Very good. For those of you just joining us on today's morning show, we have in the studios Dr. Thomas Carr and two of his students and or former students, Brett Jackson, whom we've been hearing from just now, who just made a presentation, a poster presentation, at the most recent meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. That occurred in the Twin Cities. A poster presentation on crocodile, or was it alligator?
Mix of both.
A mix of both, okay. And the modern crocodiles and alligators versus their extinct ancestors. Also with us in the studio is Andrew Gable, who is a Carthage graduate and someone who worked for a time as the preparator in the paleontology program. Now, for the moment, kindly volunteering his time. And Andrew, I know that you also attended this meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, not to actually give a presentation, but your participation there was, in a sense, for another purpose. Tell us about that.
Yeah, hi. I essentially went for networking purposes, looking for potential graduate advisors. I am currently in the market for graduate programs. I added to my list. I'm at about 14 places to apply to now.
Wow.
But I was primarily there for networking purposes because the area that I'm interested in is kind of at the intersection of archaeology and paleontology in a few ways. And prior to SVP, it was mostly anthropology departments that I had on the list thus far. But after this, I got some comparative anatomy stuff on there, too, as well as just talking to some people about possible future research, because my two major interests as far as intersections of archaeo and paleo are Pleistocene zooarchaeology. So Pleistocene bones and fossils in archaeological contexts, especially human-proboscidean interactions. So hunting, butchering, and kill sites of mammoths and mastodons during the Ice Age. And another is fossils found in later archaeological contexts and fossils that have been worked by humans as artifacts. Like I was talking to one current PhD candidate, for example. She was telling me about this colleague of hers who has worked in Brazil, who's found invertebrate fossils that show evidence of being carved by humans and stuff like that.
So human beings finding a fossil and then doing something with it.
Yes, exactly.
Not leaving it alone in pristine shape, but altering it in one way or another for maybe a variety of reasons.
Exactly, yeah. And that was something that was relatively common in pre-industrial cultures. You see, for example, ammonites being carved to some degree in Nepal, and they're seen as religious artifacts in some context there. And there are many other examples. But a lot of times when this happens, somebody's looking at it and they're either an archaeologist or a paleontologist. The paleontologist is interested in the morphological traits of the fossil animal and isn't necessarily writing much about the cultural significance of this fossil as an artifact. Or archaeologists are writing about the opposite and not really recording much about the actual morphology of the animal in some cases. So the overlap of both and wanting to kind of bring those together is something that I'm very interested in.
So in other words, you're interested in both facets of this, not only this fossil as a fossil, but also this fossil as something that early man did something with, and why did they do that? I mean, you're interested in all of it.
Yeah.
Very good.
Exactly.
So the networking that you did, tell us more about that. Was this more a case of you investigating various programs to try to determine where a good spot would be for you, or was it actually meeting people to sort out, are there people you want to really work with, or is it more about people meeting you and trying to sort out if you're right for their program? I mean, I guess maybe one way to ask it is who's investigating what and who is wooing who?
Yeah, some of column A, some of column B, I guess. Primarily the former. I was primarily looking for graduate advisors and more information about programs. Because sometimes when in just researching programs, it isn't always clear about everything that one specific potential advisor may have worked on. Just at a cursory glance. So I was just trying to find out if I could hear anything else on the grapevine, so to speak. But also just trying to find out if there are people that specialize in the latter area. There are people that specialize in human proboscidean interactions. There are several of them. And I did manage to track down a couple of them and give more information about them and their programs. But as far as the latter fossils in later archaeological contexts, I was trying to find somebody that specializes in that, and there doesn't seem to be at the time. Which, on the one hand, it's a little bit bothersome in that I can't necessarily get that exact kind of guidance that I need. But on the other hand, it's very exciting. That's kind of a wide open niche at the moment.
Right.
So hopefully I can take that over at some point.
Right. So in other words, this is sort of unplowed ground.
Yeah.
And you could be somebody who could potentially lead the way in some really serious concerted study of it.
Yeah, that's the hope.
That's right. The hope.
And there are a couple specific things that I'm very interested in working on as far as that goes, but I'll keep that hush-hush for right now, I think.
Very good. Professor Carr mentioned before we went on the air that you are otherwise hard at work at the moment on some kind of T-Rex project. Am I correct about that?
Yeah, that's correct. This is T-Rex material that we collected on the last last season of our Hell Creek expedition at Carthage College this past summer, as well as material in the previous season, which was the summer of 2022. We took 2023 off. Toward the end of the 2022 season, this was the last day, right? A student from MIAD, the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, found some material that, when he brought it back to where we were staying, it became clear that it was juvenile Tyrannosaurus material. So, of course, significant to the study of Tyrannosaur ontogeny. We went to the same locale at the beginning of this past field season, hoping to find an in situ bone. In situ essentially means in place, still partially buried. We didn't find any evidence of that, unfortunately. We didn't find any bones weathering out, but we did find a voluminous amount of fragments on the surface of the hill where he did originally find that. So we spent a pretty big chunk of the day, us and the students that we had with us, completely picking the hill clean of fragments, and multiple bags full of fragments of varying sizes, from about fist size to maybe a millimeter at the widest point across.
Wow.
Somewhere in between. Most of them weren't quite that small, but there are a few that are. And upon returning, it has been a major project of mine to clean all of those, consolidate them, and now I'm on the piecing stage. So I have easily well over 1,000 fragments laid out on a couple different tables in the museum lab that I'm currently working on piecing together. Wow. And thus far, we have found several fits with the bones that we did already have in the 2022 season, after those bones were prepped by a former assistant preparator, Brady Holbach, and then more work done by myself after the fact, it became clear that some of the bones that were found include the nasal, which is the bone at the bridge of the nose, as well as a astragalus, part of a tibia and part of a fibula, as well as a few teeth and vertebrae fragments. But onto several of those bones, I found multiple fits already, and that continues to expand. I'm working on it as much as possible, but because the position is no longer being funded by the school, and because it won't be funded by the city of Kenosha, and the grant funding had run out, I can currently only afford to come in and volunteer maybe once a week.
Sure, there's still rent to pay.
Sometimes twice.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I do have to eat. I do have bills.
Yeah.
But so work on that is a little bit slow going because of that, but every time that I do come in, several more fits are found, and it becomes a little bit closer to being done.
Right. Is it work that you do the way we would just imagine? I mean, the way you just like put a puzzle together where you're just visually looking at all of these fragments and trying to see what fits together? Or are there tools that can be an aid to you in doing this piecing work?
In our specific lab, there aren't these tools. I know that some people have... I know that some institutions have started doing scans of bones and using AI-assisted technology to help with that, but we don't have that at our facility. So it is ultimately...
The old-fashioned way.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. There are some strategic ways to do that. For example, right now I'm working on a lot of superficial long bone fragments, so those are all pretty texturally similar. So I have those sequestered from the rest, and you do kind of have to be systematic with it because these fits aren't always going to be obvious just by sight. So you pick up one piece, and then you go through all of the rest of the pieces that look like they could conceivably be a fit, rotate all of them all around all of the sides, and see if there's a little click when you do that.
Wow.
Because sometimes, as well, the colors of the pieces are noticeably different because that can come down to when the bones break, which they inevitably do when they're exposed because Montana does have temperature extremes. It's the same way the cracks form on sidewalks. There's hot summers and cold winters. It expands and contracts and shatters. When that does happen, sometimes one piece or one side of one piece is going to get more sunlight than the other just because of the way that it tumbles down the hill. So sometimes two pieces can fit together very cleanly but be completely different colors. So that can complicate things as well. So you do really have to be systematic to make sure you don't miss anything.
Right. And because we're talking about fragments that have just been exposed to the elements, isn't it also possible that certain fragments have been so worn by whatever that they can't fit together anymore the way that they maybe once could?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. There are a few fragments that we do have within this one specimen that does seem to be the case for. Sometimes edges are very rounded, especially with the internal parts of the bone. A lot of that is cancellous, kind of like that spongy, porous texture. That's a lot more fragile than the cortex, the outside of the bone. So that's very easily weathered away and kind of ground down to kind of nondescript round shapes as opposed to a relatively more jagged shape that you can easily see interlocking with something else.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you enjoy this?
Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah. I find it kind of fun. Especially like you do get after looking at a tray of jagged little bone fragments and then finding a fit for a while, that is a nice little dopamine boost that carries you to the next one. But it's enjoyable, and there is a real sense of accomplishment seeing the pieced together part of the fossil continuously grow as you work.
Right. And is this something that has a finish line? I mean, where you could potentially be done with this? I mean, it almost sounds like something you could work on for the rest of your life.
Not quite that bad.
Okay.
Not quite that bad. But yeah, it is a big project, absolutely. But yeah, well, once I feel I've reached the point where I've held up every piece next to every other piece, then I will call it done.
Wow.
With the material that we had collected in 2022, it was the same kind of thing. I looked at all of the pieces that we had, and several of the bones that were already pieced together did grow more, but I did reach the point where no more pieces were being found, and I felt I've matched everything up, so I was able to call that done. Wow. And we have a lot more now, so it's going to be a longer time frame before that happens here, but it will happen. There is an end for this.
Wow. Dr. Carr?
Yeah, if I could just add to this, it is finite. There's a finite number of fragments, and this sort of task is something that Andrew excels at. He's very good at finding fits quickly, and that makes him the ideal person to be working on this project. So the confidence I have in Andrew is that this won't drag out, you know, for years on end. There is a finish line, and we'll get there. Much quicker with Andrew than really with anyone else I've seen in the lab.
Wow. words of high praise. We're speaking with Dr. Thomas Carr and with Andrew Goble and Brett Jackson about various projects. And Professor Carr, you made a presentation yourself at this latest meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. And in your email to me, you talked about this presentation being part of what you termed an ongoing tussle related to T-Rex. In a nutshell, tell us about this ongoing tussle and your contribution to it.
Yeah, this goes all the way back to 1942, when the little skull of a tyrannosaur was found in southeastern Montana, just several miles away from where we're collecting. And it was published in 1946 and called Gorgosaurus lancensis. It was thought to be a small adult tyrannosaur that shared turf with T. rex. It's from rocks of the same age. Rex is from the same area. And later it was moved into its own genus, so a brand new name. Gorgosaurus is already an animal already known. And it was, in 1988, dubbed now Tyrannus. And it was also at that time thought to be an adult because sutures apparently were closed. And I came around in 1999 and published the hypothesis that it's really a juvenile T-Rex because the sutures claim to be closed or open. Has all the juvenile features of other juvenile tyrannosaurs, and it has features only seen in adult rexes. And ever since then, people have been arguing over this skull, and in the years that have passed, I haven't seen any evidence to persuade me otherwise that the juvenile hypothesis is incorrect. There's no evidence to suggest that. And yet, earlier this year, an article was published arguing for Nanotyrannus, and the authors made three unsubstantiated claims regarding the literature, regarding growth trends in tyrannosaurs, and so my goal was to straighten those out. And so I did that, and what was interesting was that one of the authors whose work I critiqued afterwards shook my hand and thanked me for engaging in their work.
Wow.
And I thought that was really quite professional. I was quite impressed with that.
Yeah.
It wasn't what I was, the reaction I was expecting. Like, I wasn't on the attack. My goal was to just, you know, straighten a few things out.
Right. Did you interpret that to any extent as being a concession, that he was, in a sense, agreeing with your concerns or critique, or was it did not quite rise to that level?
It didn't rise to that level, and it doesn't need to. You know, science is all about testing hypotheses. The concern I have, in part with this case and others, is that the overall goal of science is to arrive at the single hypothesis of nature. We're not here to proliferate hypotheses that conflict. Like, there's one history, therefore one truth, and science is the one way of getting there. And so the main issue with this whole nanotyrannus problem is the fossil record itself. There aren't many juvenile tyrannosaur or subadult tyrannosaur material from the Hell Creek Formation and its equivalents. And so I think a lot of this tussle is just over our incomplete knowledge of T-Rex and its early development. And it will be resolved, but, you know, it's been 132 years since we've been collecting, and, you know, juveniles and subadults are still rare, and I don't expect to resolve this for another century.
Wow. Yeah. So you may not be around for the ultimate resolution of this question.
Well, I think I resolved it in 1999.
As far as you're concerned, yes.
For other people's satisfaction, it'll take them a century to wait.
That's how the business goes. That's how the business goes. In our closing couple of minutes, I know that you've already touched on the fact that that what you and your program have achieved has been in spite of some real difficulties.
Yeah.
Just sketch for us what your hopes are in terms of moving forward from here.
Well, my hopes are that either the college or the city will pony up and support the preparator position. I mean, it's a bargain basement salary, at least historically it has been that. It won't break the bank for anyone. And if, you know, the college and city are serious about promoting and supporting a competitive program, they better move pretty quickly because, you know, I used to offer to students a program that includes experience in the lab, field, and research. Mm-hmm. Now we're just carved down to research, and that puts our program on its back foot. You know, if we want to compete with other institutions and larger institutions, and we've done that successfully, we're behind.
Right, suddenly behind.
Suddenly, abruptly behind. And the fix for this is easy. Right. It's just one little staff position that just solves the whole thing.
Right. And, of course, it's partly because you want to continue to attract the Brett Jacksons and Andrew Goebbels of the world.
Exactly. You know, we're here to contribute to the futures of our students. And we know for a fact that graduate schools won't consider students without all three legs of the stool, you know, lab, research, and field. And if, you know, if we're bringing students in right now, it's almost under false pretenses. You know, and I am honest with students that about our situation, but I think it's unrealistic for the administration to expect this program to thrive when it's chopped off at the knees.
Right. Well, we certainly are following this with great interest and concern about what is ahead, and we certainly hope there a way can be found for the excellent work that has been part of the paleontology program to resume and to continue. And in the meantime, I appreciate your time today in talking about this interesting experience that you had, along with the two young men you've brought along with you. Brett Jackson, about to graduate with a biology major, who made a poster presentation at this latest meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, and Andrew Gabel, who is continuing to volunteer his time as much as he can to the paleontology program. We appreciate all three of you joining us today on the morning show, and very best wishes to all of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be hearing from the archives a conversation from back in 2010 with local author Michael Schumacher, talking about his book, Will Eisner, A Dreamer's Life in Comics. Will Eisner, such an important and intriguing figure in American culture. And then on Wednesday, a work in progress that I am excited to share with you, an online tribute, on-air tribute to Norm McPhee, who served for more than three decades as the managing and artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild from 1969 to 2001, and then continued to serve as a guest director from time to time until 2016. Norm McPhee passed away earlier this month at the age of 88, and on Wednesday you're going to be hearing an array of recollections about Norm McPhee from several people who knew him well, including Mona Lewis, Joe Nissen, George Mangold, Michael Klickner, and Doug Instanis. That is coming up Wednesday on The Morning Show, with no morning show broadcast then on Thursday or Friday because of the Thanksgiving holiday, although you can hear a different morning show every day this coming week and through the weekend by enjoying The Morning Show podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today, partly sunny skies and a high temperature of 51 degrees. A few clouds overnight with an overnight low down to 25. Tomorrow will be sunny and chilly. Tomorrow's high just 38 degrees. We do show a 30% chance of rain on Wednesday. Right now, cloudy and cold on Thursday, Thanksgiving Day. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine,